This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along. Thank you so much for listening. It's another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Yeah, cheers for giving us a download and a listen. This is the show that brings you all the most amazing, weird and wonderful stuff from all over the universe. This week, we're heading up Fire Mountain in Dangerous Dan. Brace yourselves for that. Also, for once, we finally got some good news to share about climate change, and we'll chat to an animal expert on the show all about dinosaur sharks. That's on the way. Can't wait for that. It's coming up after we catch up with one of our favourite geniuses on the show. It's Professor Hallux, and this time, he's still looking at your gob.
Professor Hallux's Digital Dental Depository, with support from Philips Sonicare.
To honour great Uncle Halitosis, dentist extraordinaire, on the occasion of his 100th birthday, Professor Hallux is creating a pop-up digital dental depository, an oral health help desk. He's going to see how many questions all about teeth he can answer against the clock.
It's a super sweet set of sizzlers today, Nanobot. All about sugar. Wind it up and let it go.
First question, how does sugar harm our teeth?
It's not the sugar itself that causes damage to teeth. It's the acid the bacteria creates when it consumes the sugar. Sugar is a source of food and energy to bacteria, you see. And as they break it down, acids are produced. This acid breaks through the enamel on your teeth, creating tiny holes which can cause your teeth to be sensitive to both hot and cold temperatures. Over time, those tiny holes can get bigger and bigger until they form large holes, called cavities. And that's tooth decay.
Good start. Oh, it's a true or false? In the UK, sugar has been causing harm to our teeth for thousands of years. True or false?
I'm going to say false. It's false because we only started to import sugar in the Tudor period. That's from the late 1400s. Scientists know from studying the teeth in skeletons that before then, people's teeth were actually pretty healthy. The first sugar and sugary delicacies were luxuries, and only for the rich. Queen Elizabeth I was so fond of sugar, it said her teeth were rotten and black. By the 1700s, sugar was available to everyone, and that's when tooth decay became more common. Funnily enough, that's when dentistry also became more common, with all those yucky, rotten teeth to pull out.
Ew! So, if you can't resist sweet treats, what's the best way to prevent damage?
Well, drinking water is a helpful way to wash the acids away. Your own spit or saliva contains minerals which can help repair damage to your teeth, so it's important to stay hydrated. The acid attacks from bacteria only last around 20 minutes, so it's better to eat sweet things over short periods, not over a long period of guzzling pop or munching on snacks. That way, you're reducing the amount of time your teeth are under attack. And using a straw is a great way to stop a sweet drink coating your teeth. And don't forget to use a paper or reusable straw. Much better for the environment than single-use plastic.
Coming up to the finish now. You should always clean your teeth as soon as you've had a sugary snack or drink. Is that true or false?
It's actually false. When the acid is being produced, it can actually cause more harm if you brush your teeth straight away, as you might be helping the acid through the enamel. It's better to use a mouthwash and save your brushing for twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. Using an electric toothbrush and flossing can help ensure you get into all the cracks.
That's correct. And time's up. Brilliant, Professor. Very respectable score there and lots of data for our digital dental depository.
Professor Hallux's Digital Dental Depository with support from Philips Sonicare. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux.
Now, remember, there are two ways that you can get in touch with the Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a sciencey question that's niggling around your head, if you want to ask an expert, you need to go through me first. I'll tell you one of those ways in just a sec. First, I want to share with you my favourite way of you saying hello to us. It's by leaving the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review over on the iTunes podcast store. Find us on there. You get a section to put your name in. That's great. I know who you are. You can leave us 5 stars if you fancy. At the bottom, there's a comment section. Please then let me know your question. That's the best place to do it. Joseph, who is 9, has done that. He asks why apes and monkeys are so like us. Well, it's because they're just a few strands of DNA away from us, Joseph. We are almost apes and monkeys. We evolved from those like hundreds and thousands, maybe even millions of years ago. They're just one step away from humans, Homo sapiens, who we are. Anyway, to get proper confirmation on that, to find out exactly how close we are in DNA to apes and monkeys, I'll get a proper expert on the show for you soon, Joseph. Thanks for getting in touch. Also, hello to Ollie and Josh for their brilliant questions. There's a couple of those. I'm searching for a genius to answer those for you as we speak. And finally, today, Martin Cameron Brown has been on the iTunes podcast store and asks if the sun will ever turn into a red giant. Martin, I think in about like 5 billion years, when the sun gets so big, it expands so much that it absorbs Mercury, Venus, Mars, even us, it will officially be classed as a red giant. But to get the proper timeline on that, I will find a space expert for you, Martin. Thanks so much for getting in touch. If you've got a science question that you want answered by an expert, the best way to let me know is to leave the Fun Kids Science Weekly a review over on the iTunes podcast store. Now, leaving a review on the iTunes podcast store, it's not the only way of asking an expert a question on the show, because if you download the free Fun Kids app, on there, there's a button that says record a message. So you can record your question to an expert on there. It'll automatically come through to us, and then we'll do the rest. Look, just like this, it's so easy.
Hello, my name is Indy, and I'm 7, and this is my question. How long ago did the last megalodon swim?
Now, Dr. Catalina Pimiento is from Swansea University, and she's here to answer it. Catalina, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for calling me.
No, well, thank you so much for helping us figure this out. So, tell us more, the megalodon, how long ago did it swim?
Well, our studies have shown that the last megalodon, or they became extinct around 2.5 million years ago. So that is way after dinosaurs went extinct, but also way before humans first evolved. So it was between the two. So a human never got to see a megalodon, but a dinosaur either.
So the megalodon wasn't swimming in the sea while the dinosaurs were here either. They were a kind of in-betweeny thing.
Exactly, yeah. When the megalodon first evolved, the dinosaurs were long gone. And so they swim in the oceans for about 20 million years, and then they became extinct right before humans first evolved. So we just missed them.
Can you tell us a bit more about what the megalodon is, what it looks like, what it would feed on deep down under the sea?
Yeah. So megalodon was the biggest shark that ever lived. So it was as big as a school bus, for example. It was almost 18 meters in total length, at the maximum size of this shark. So it's indeed the biggest shark and the biggest mega predatory animal. When I say mega predatory, I mean that they can eat big things, because there are a lot of big things as well around, but that eat small things like plankton and krill and shrimps and things like that. But megalodon was very big and ate big things as well. Mm-hmm. So it was swimming around all the oceans of the world. It wasn't just in a particular area. It was able to swim along long distances in many different places.
Did it have any particular qualities that may have made it stand out from a shark, apart from being as big as a bus?
Yeah, well, it was very similar to the grey white, but their teeth, and that's the only remains we have now, is their teeth. Their teeth were really, really big. So they are as big as a grown-up hand. So if you see your hand and you stretch it, and then that's how big a tooth could be. So we only know that they had very big teeth, And we also know that those teeth are particularly similar to the great white shark. So we assume that it was similar in shape and overall ecology or the things they did in the oceans. But we don't really have any full skeleton of Megalodon to be sure exactly how it looked like.
So if it was around for 20 million years before we were, yeah, it must have come across a whole different range of animals that we have almost no clue about. Do you have any idea what creatures it would have shared the sea with, maybe the other animals that were roaming around on Earth at that time?
Yeah, so Megalodon was swimming with a lot of giants, actually. There were a lot of giant whales that are not as big as the whales that we find today, because nowadays we have very big whales, but back then there were also big whales, big predatory whales, and also different types of sharks. But actually, the world that we have now in the oceans is not that different from the one that it was 20 million years ago. It seems like after the extinction of dinosaurs, everything that we have now evolved, and it has been kind of the same. Of course, there have been new things and new animals, some of them became extinct. Actually, almost one-third of all the big animals became extinct around the same time as Megalodon, of the big marine animals. But those are the ancestors of the animals that we see today. So they were somehow similar to the ones we have today. So it's very hard to say that they were like a complete different alien kind of world. It's very similar to the one we have today, at least in the oceans.
If you say a third of marine animals went extinct around that time, do we have any idea why? I mean, obviously, we know the first mass extinction event when the dinosaur, well, one of the first, when the dinosaurs all went. Why did the Megalodon go?
Yeah, so actually the extinction of dinosaurs is the last extinction event, so the last mass extinction event. There has been five, and the extinction of dinosaurs was the fifth. And actually we're experiencing the sixth extinction right now, because a lot of animals are going extinct in a very, very fast rate. But in the time that Megalodon became extinct, a third of marine megafauna, of the big animals of the oceans, also went extinct. This wasn't massive, because it was only a third. And when it's a massive extinction, then you have that 70% like of the animals were extinct. But in this case, it wasn't that bad. But we think that it was actually because if the people who are listening remember the movie Ice Age, around that time where the Ice Age was. But the Ice Age was actually a series of ice ages. So it was an ice age and then not ice, then ice age, not ice, and ice age. And these changes in the level of how much ice there were, it changed very rapidly. So in just a matter of thousands of years, which is very rapid for how long the Earth is, there was these massive changes of ice, no ice, ice, no ice. And with that, sea level changed dramatically, because there was ice in the poles, and then there was not. So the sea level was increasing, decreasing, increasing, decreasing. And we think that because of those violent changes in sea level, these big animals became extinct, because they're so big, they need to eat a lot of food and they need to be able to find it. But if sea level is changing so much and so fast, then they struggle to find food. And that's why we think Megalodon and all the other animals became extinct around that time.
Catalina, you said that we're in the middle, scientists think, of another mass extinction event. And if 70% of creatures need to go, how long a time span do we give for something to be classed as a mass extinction event? Like, is it over 100 years, 100,000 years, 100 million years? How long from beginning to end do these things tend to last?
Well, that's the thing. But that the history of Earth has shown us that actually mass extinction events take millions of years to take place. So it actually happens. Sometimes it happens because of an asteroid, for example, that in the case of dinosaurs, it was one event that, boom, happened. But the reason why we're experiencing a mass extinction right now is because, different to the other ones, it's happening really fast. So I said that it takes millions of years. Let's say it takes hundreds of thousands of years. But what we're seeing today is in a second, that in relative to how long or how old the Earth is taking place, this extinction, in very short time, in hundreds of years. I mean, there was a report that said that this week that in only since the industrial revolution, so let's say the last 100 years, we have lost almost 60% of the population. So it's happening so fast that it's going to be the greatest of all mass extinctions because it's happening too fast. It's not because there were never mass extinctions before. It's because it's happening unprecedentedly fast.
And it's all our fault, isn't it, Catalina?
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, we're not doing enough to protect our oceans and our biodiversity, and we're not doing enough to protect the Earth. And the Earth is going to survive because that's what the Earth has been doing for millions of years. So the Earth is going to be there, but what is not going to remain is the animals that live there. The Earth has a way to come back and to survive mass extinctions, and then something completely different will evolve. But it's so sad that we're doing it such a high speed, and it's actually affecting us directly, because at the end of the day, it's us humans who are not going to be able to enjoy how amazing the Earth is if we continue, destroying the biodiversity.
Thank you so much for asking the question. Not the happiest way to end, but Dr. Catalina Pimiento, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly and helping us out.
Sure.
Time for this week's Dangerous Dan, then, where we look at some of the most mean and evil things that exist in nature. Today, we are headed to Indonesia, to the island of Java, to take a closer peek at Fire Mountain. But don't worry, we'll keep a good, safe distance away. From the comfort of your own home or wherever you are right now, you don't need to move because you don't want to go close to this thing. It is seriously deadly. Mount Meripai, it's 400,000 years old. It reaches 9,610 feet above sea level. And its name, Mount Meripai, it translates into English as Mountain of Fire. It's an actual fire mountain, a proper volcano. Now it's erupted 60 times. It can spew lava and molten rock over 8 miles around its base. It most recently erupted earlier on this year in 2018. It's one of 16 decade mountains. And these are the ones that scientists class as being seriously dangerous. The ones that you're most worth paying attention to. The thing is, even when it's not on full-on eruption mode, it's never properly resting, never properly dormant. In its most relaxed times, smoke floats ominously from its mouth. Always rising, always letting you know, I'm here and I'm ready to go. It's constantly seeping ash. The most dangerous part is that 200,000 villagers live almost on the volcano. There are towns high up in the rocks that make up Mount Meripai. Because this is an island, this is people's home. There's nowhere else to go. Fire Mountain is their only option. You can hear about the strange way that a fungus might make enough energy to try and help us save the world in a little bit. First, let's catch up with Bex from the club on Fun Kids and me. We're travelling all around the UK. We're looking at Britain's digital railways.
Britain's digital railway.
Whether it's passengers on a fast intercity service, a branch line to the coast, or commuters travelling to work on a tram or tube, Britain's railways are certainly busy. Bex and Dan are joining the passengers and learning that the number of people using the railways is expected to grow, and that things are going to have to change.
Hey Dan, how long till our train gets here?
Another 10 minutes? Why don't you find us something to watch online whilst we're waiting?
Oh, this looks cool. This video is called The Digital Railway. Let's check it out.
Today, Britain's railway network carries over 3 million people every day. That's 1.3 billion journeys each year. And with the population set to increase, within 20 years, there will be double the amount of rail passengers.
Oh my goodness. Where will all these passengers go? Maybe we'll all be like squashed in, like sardines maybe. Or maybe they might make double-decker trains, one of those. I think I've got it, though. Maybe we'll have to hang on to the train roof, you know, a bit like ninjas in an action movie.
Yeah, chill out, Dan. Although, actually, no, it might be quite cool to hang out on the roof like a ninja.
That's certainly cool.
I mean, I'm sure they'll just make more trains and just shove them on the track. Then Bob's your uncle, room for everyone.
Won't that cause a load of train traffic jams, though, and affect the environment?
Yeah, I suppose. You might need to come up with a way to make the railways super safe and super clean, with all the extra trains.
What if each train could carry more people? You could perhaps get rid of the seats and just make everyone stand up?
Yeah, come on, you moan more than anybody if you can't get a seat.
Fair point. I do like a seat, I can't lie. Maybe trains could just go faster. You know, fill them with rocket fuel and let them go at like 300 miles an hour. That way they can make journeys faster and take all the extra passengers.
Yeah, but to go really fast, you want the track to be as straight and as flat as possible, right? I mean, too many curves and hills, you might have to slow down. Just think, if you go too fast on a bumpy track, you might actually end up in orbit.
Gosh, it's tough, isn't it?
Or maybe they'll just build, like, a million more miles of super track. That way there could be room for tons of new trains.
Just imagine, though, when you look out of the window, all you'd see was track and trains. Cool, if you like trains.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone is gonna want trains zooming past their house, and building a load of new tracks is gonna be expensive, right? So that doesn't really sound like a solution either.
I suppose that means they're gonna have to work with the track that already exists.
Dan and Bex are right. The railway network has to work with what it's got. Luckily, like with many other parts of life, technology has advanced to help. With careful planning, the capacity on the network can be increased. That means more trains carrying more passengers. It's a challenge that engineers are excited about, and one they're calling the digital railway. It might sound a bit like a computer game, but it just means using the very latest tech developments to get more trains on the network, travelling more efficiently and safely.
Right on time. Come on, hurry up.
Let me guess. You want to bag a seat.
Britain's Digital Railway, with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at bunkidslive.com/railway.
Let's talk about all the science that has been in the news this week then. Scientists, they're meeting in Leicester in the UK to choose a landing site on Mars for Europe's 2020 rover. The six-wheeled robot, it'll head to the red planet in a few years' time, but landing on Mars, it's notoriously hard. Most efforts to try and get there fail. But if ExoMars from Europe can manage it, it's going to use a drill to get below the surface and try and find signs of life. Also, US researchers, they've tested the idea of making electricity from a bionic mushroom. They want to attach bacteria to the cap of the mushroom, special bacteria, which can make energy, and then they want to fill fields with these and hopefully make some new power, try and save the world. And finally, speaking of saving the world, the ozone layer, which protects us from damaging ultraviolet rays from space, that it looks to be healing holes, which were found 30 years ago up in the ozone layer. The holes, they're caused by deodorant cans, aerosols that we use, CFC gases, and it looks like the holes in the northern hemisphere of the ozone layer, it could be fixed by the 2030s, and the holes above Antarctica, where there's loads, fingers crossed, they'll be fixed by 2060. That is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen, giving us a download. Remember, if you've got a science question, something niggling around your brain that you really want answered, or something that you know maybe that you want confirmed by a proper expert, the best thing to do is to let me know first. Go through me. I will then find an appropriate expert to ask for you. You can ask me as a review over on the iTunes podcast store. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there. Leave your name. Drop us 5 stars if you fancy. In the comment box, ask me your question. I will sort it out for you. Also, while you're on iTunes, you can find all of our brilliant Fun Kids Science series on there. Some that you've heard today. There are loads more out there as well. You can also download them on the free Fun Kids app. And you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a kids radio station from the UK. You can listen to us on your DAB digital radio at home, on the free Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station, Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.